Vijay Prashad, welcome to COVID Race and Democracy. Please introduce yourself and tell us what's important for our listeners to know about you and about your work.
Well, it's good to be with you. I'm the director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, which is located in India, South Africa, Argentina, Brazil. We do basically what we call movement-driven research. I'm also the chief correspondent for Globetrotter, which is a syndication service of basically international news. And I'm the chief editor of a publishing house in New Delhi called Leftward Books. So that's all the stuff I busy myself with.
And where are you talking to us from now?
Well, yes, I'm in Santiago, Chile.
Wow. Okay. So let's start by clarifying our terms. This is a multi-part series on U.S. imperialism. And how would you define that concept, imperialism? What does it mean to say that the U.S. is an empire or an imperialist nation?
You see, imperialism is a very old term, and it goes back to the 19th century when there was a reflection on the difference between direct colonialism and something other than direct colonialism. So when a country like, let's say, India colonizes a part of West Africa, let's say what is Nigeria, and holds it where the country of Nigeria has no political sovereignty any longer. It has no economic sovereignty, no social sovereignty, and maybe some cultural sovereignty. Obviously, you can't, you know, totally suffocate a culture, but a lot of its sovereignty has been taken away in the process. So that's colonialism. But what happens if you have a situation where the British say, well, we're going to leave Nigeria, we're going to have you be independent, so you get your political sovereignty back, you might have some economic sovereignty back, some policy making goes back to the hands of the Nigerians, but there's still an overwhelming power over the country. Well, the shape of the world system constructed through the colonial period is such that countries that are in mainly the global south, but not only in the global south, have their operating ability constrained. And those constraints are what we call imperialism. So for instance, you know, if a country like Nigeria says, then look, we need to borrow money, you know, on the open market to develop a dam. Well, you know, you as the colonial masters of the past stole all this wealth from us, which now is your basically your capital. Rather than just say, look, in recompense, in you know, as a way of coming back and just giving you this wealth to build yourself, we're going to now charge you interest, we're going to make you borrow money and so on. We'll make you more and more in debt, which constrains your sovereignty even more. So imperialism is this extra economic force, the use of debt, the use of sometimes direct intimidation and threat to gain economic advantages for both the countries of the North and Northern-based multinational corporations. You know, it's a very complicated process, but it has a simple aim, which is to make sure that the vast bulk of the billions of the planet are essentially kept at levels of of life. Their standard of living is kept down to maintain their wage levels down to mean they can be super exploited in a global system that advantages multinational corporations.
We especially see that transition from direct colonialism to neocolonialism, especially after World War II, where the U.S. emerges as the dominant imperialist power, and then the wave of independence movements and national liberation movements in the 60s. So you mentioned control over financing. What are a couple other key levers in that transition from direct colonial rule to imperial control?
There's a range of things. I mean, direct financial control is one. Financing for development, that's the term of art. If a country needs to develop any part of its economy, it requires external finance. They don't have the resources within the country. You know, you can't redistribute poverty. You need to build some wealth. So if you're going to import capital from elsewhere, that capital is used in a way to entrap you further. That financing for development or finance control That's a huge part of the way in which countries are constrained. But it's not the only way, you know. There's a way in which military forces are utilized to intimidate countries. If you go in that direction, then you may be overthrown. Your government might be overthrown. It often is overthrown. You tried to nationalize your oil in Iran in 1953. Mohammad Mossadegh's government is overthrown. You tried to do land reforms, modest land reforms in Guatemala, which impinges on what United Fruit, which is an American fruit company. United Fruit thinks it's a sovereign right to exploit Guatemalan land and people. Well, if you try to do land reform, your government is overthrown, the government of Jacob Arbenz, 1954. So the issue is that not only is it, you know, you use finance to control, it's a form of abstract domination. You say, well, you want money, here's the money, but you have to pay interest rates much higher than we'll lend to other people. The money lent to the third world was always more expensive than the money that the first world countries lent to each other. So that's a more abstract structural form of domination. More obvious ones were intimidation, gunboat diplomacy, coup d'etats, you know, threats against people, assassination, and so on. That's also part of the imperialist project. And then, you know, anytime a group of countries came forward to propose an alternative, there was a kind of information war used against them. You delegitimize these countries, you say they're authoritarian, you say that they are against the free market. I mean, give you an example. When OPEC was first put forward as an idea, you know, that's the organization of petroleum exporting countries, you know, they said, oh, you can't create a cartel because a cartel is against the free market. But meanwhile, of course, there are all kinds of cartels that Western companies have in place, including today in the middle of COVID-19 pandemic. You've essentially got a cartel of manufacturers of vaccines. You know, they operate in a cartel fashion. They all lobby. Excuse me. They all lobby. All these, this cartel of pharmaceutical companies ends up lobbying in the World Trade Organization to prevent a waiver from being put forward that allows, you know, no patents for the COVID-19 vaccines, the array of vaccines. So they can operate as a cartel, that's fine. But when countries of the global south try to get together, they're called authoritarian, they're called dictatorships, they are said to be against free market principles and so on. So you have this pressure on finance, you have military pressure, quite overt, you know, use of threat, use of force. And then you have a kind of information war, which is quite captivating because, you know, what CNN says, well, it's in fact what the State Department, U.S. State Department says, what the U.S. State Department says is what CNN says. And then what CNN says is what media outlets around the world sometimes say. And that produces a kind of information suffocation, you know, that prevents alternative projects from being taken seriously.
And then, of course, we have sanctions.
Well, you have sanctions, and sanctions are interesting because, so sanctions are somewhere between the financial pressures that can be put on a country and intimidation and military force. Because, you see, when you read the UN Charter, when you read the United Nations Charter of 1945, there's some room for pressuring a country to behave, you know, let's say that this country has got some sort of genocidal project. There's a way to use non-economic, economic and other forms of pressure to get the government to behave itself. I mean, the UN Charter allows various forms of multilateral pressure to be put on countries. But the US government, against the UN Charter, has developed its own agenda of sanctions. It is currently sanctioning over 30 countries. The way this operates is because most countries rely on the US dollar to reconcile their trade, you know, for reasons that are quite practical. They use the dollar, it's fiat currency around the world. Because of that, the United States, since the US government controls the dollar to a great extent, is able to close off access to the dollar to some countries. And that produces enormous problems for countries. Iran is going through problems, Venezuela going through problems. So that's sanctions using the financial lever. But sanctions are not only financial, they also have intimidation, they also have a military threat. Because, you know, you can then blockade a country, you can prevent trade from coming in and out, you can stop things that a country might need to import, saying these are dual-use technology and so on. It has a military impact. You can weaken a country's resolve, and then eventually it's easy to overthrow a country, which is why I say sanctions is somewhere between financial warfare and direct warfare.
Thank you. That really gives us a very good historical context and overview, and really of the whole strategy shift from colonialism to modern day. I'd like to focus in on the existential environmental crises that are intensifying everywhere. How is U.S. imperialism impacting global ecosystems? And what does that mean for the future of all life on the planet?
Yes, so there is no doubt. If you're a close observer of things, you'll see there is no doubt that this great, ravenous appetite that the world has for commodifying goods and services, commodifying everything, commodifying nature of all kinds, commodifying the air, for God's sake, where you'll commodify water. I mean, the idea that water is a commodity that can be traded, that should, send people to have their heads explode. But there is this ravenous way in which capitalism moves towards the commodification of everything. Commodification of water, I talked about. Commodification of leisure. Exercising is commodified. You can have shops where you can go and exercise and so on. I mean, everything gets commodified. And the more you commodify it, the less respect there is for the limits to commodification, the limits to growth. There are no limits set. It's a boundless thing. You can commodify everything in the world, make money on anything. Then there is no limit. And the less idea you have of limits, the less respect you have for the limits of the capacity of the earth to hold, capitalist desire, the less you appreciate that there are limits in the environment, limits in nature and so on. The less you appreciate that, the more you will continue to destroy the planet. So there is an inbuilt tendency in capitalism to basically turn everything into an opportunity to make money. Well, that's the doom of the planet. I mean, what else can one say? Can capitalism save the planet from climate change? I don't think so. There is now this idea that you can commodify the crisis by saying, let's trade, in emissions. If I emit more and I emit beyond my so-called capacity to emit, then I must pay a price to somebody. You'll make me internalize the costs to the environment of what I'm doing. That doesn't change the course of history. That merely is a way to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. We're not saying, look, let's think about this. Do we really need to have so much plastic produced? Is wrapping that important? I mean, is growth to be ceaseless? Is there a way for people, particularly in the advanced industrial countries where they are using way more than their share of global resources, is there a need to have the lights on in every room of your house? And I don't mean to make this an individual issue, but let us stay with the individual issue. Is there a need for every human being in the United States to have a car? Do you really need to build cities which are reliant upon driving? Can't we live with public transportation, mass public transportation that links cities to each other, that links neighborhoods to each other, so everybody doesn't need to drive a car? It seems a great waste of energy. Is there a need to have this idea that, you can have many, many different, places where you socialize? Why not have a better use of or even live? I mean, this idea of semi-detached houses that we have in advanced industrial countries, is this necessary? Studies have shown us that having apartment buildings is a much better use of energy. Could that be better? We'd build more social communities anyway. So these are the kinds of issues that need to be asked. Capitalism itself doesn't solve the exact problem that it has created. We need to have more social solutions. And I'm very much in favor of more public transport, more public housing, things like that. It's far better than the individualization and atomization of life. Individualization and atomization seems to increase our carbon footprint, and that's something of concern.
Thank you for that. And there are multiple ecosystems that are degrading. As they degrade, what is the actual impact on people? I mean, can you draw some of the larger connections, like how that impacts the ability of people to produce food, how that relates to immigration, just what some of the impact is of not taking care of the earth.
Well, if you don't take care of the earth, you're already seeing the impact of it. We don't have to anticipate. I mean, already you're seeing small island states find it very hard to survive. There have already been a couple of small island communities that have vanished with rising sea levels. You'll see more and more small island states be rattled by the changes in the climate, which are entirely induced by capitalism, by the kind of aggressive use of fossil fuels and so on. So you're already seeing that. You're already seeing turbulent weather patterns, you know, things shifting and changing and so on. That's already on the table. You see, with food, it's interesting because I'm not sure we as yet feel the immense burden of the shifts in cropping patterns as a consequence of climate changes directly. We see the shift in cropping patterns quite dramatically, driven by, you know, the increase of cash cropping, where there's a move to grow things that are either fed to animals as animal feed. As the food chain changes, people are eating more meat, therefore they are growing things just for the animals to grow. We are already seeing a lot of acreage, arable land going towards growing fuel rather than going towards growing food. I mean, there's maybe up to a billion people who struggle with starvation every day. Half the world's population struggles with one form of hunger or the other. It's actually quite an abomination. You know, the levels of rising hunger, some of it occasioned by this pandemic. We still have enough food in the planet. That's not the problem. The problem is people don't have money to buy the food. But there is a general tendency where we're losing acreage, we're losing arable land to some extent to real estate, but much more so towards fuel, towards growing food for animals, you know. And this is not just animals in general. This is basically commodities to grow, you know, beef, to grow pork and so on. You're putting acreage in to grow these commodities. People are eating more meat in the world and so on. So there needs to be a serious discussion, I think, maybe at the UN level and so on, about what kind of world are we living in? I mean, what kind of life? We've got hunger rates increasing. At the same time, we have the increase of arable land going towards growing food for animals that we will eat, and not we. You see, half the population doesn't get to eat the increased livestock that's produced. There are people who are eating livestock, are eating more of it. And so on. So I think there needs to be some global discussion and dialogue. We don't really have a good platform, credible platform. We know that the advanced industrial countries really don't care about these issues. They've made it very clear they don't care because they block serious discussion about them. I mean, I think there's got to be room to talk about how shifting cropping patterns is going to, in the medium term, have a serious impact on the well-being of people.
Thank you for that, Vijay. I want to go back to some of the early history about how a major driver of imperialism is the desire to profit from and control the world's energy resources and strategic minerals. And that may have been a secret at one point, but that does not seem to be so much of a secret anymore, although it's all still, again, being covered in the right to protect human rights, etc. But I'm wondering if you could summarize some of the ways that this drive, in particular around profiting from and controlling the world's oil, energy resources, and strategic minerals, is driving policy.
Well, I mean, just recently, the Vice President of the United States, Kamala Harris, talked quite openly about how these wars have been pushed basically for resource reasons. These are resource wars. She talked about oil and so on. Yes, of course, it's true that people go to war for a reason. They don't go to war for no reason. Now, they would like you to believe that their reasons are high-minded, you know, human rights, democracy, and so on. But look, when it comes down to it, they seem to go to war for human rights in countries that have a lot of important resources. They don't go to war for human rights in countries that don't have a lot of resources. So that's interesting. That should make some eyebrows get raised and so on. So why was Iraq so important? I mean, good God, it wasn't just because Saddam is some brutal dictator. There are plenty of you know, as it were, brutal dictators that don't seem to focus the energy of the United States. You know, the Central African Republic is run by a fellow who has his own terrible record. Well, Mr. Obama was sitting quite comfortably with him. And on the other side of it, of course, the United States, which is the largest incarcerator of people in the planet, has its own problems with human rights. So to believe that the U.S. is going to war in another country to defend human rights, that beggars imagination. First, sort out your own house before you go and use your bombs to, you know, so-called sort out other people's houses. Well, the plain fact is they don't go to war in places like Iraq for human rights reasons. They go to war for plain reasons, which is not to get, not to seize the oil. That's not the point. The point is to control the oil. It's not to seize the oil. They are quite happy for the oil to be sold to China, whoever wants to buy the oil. The issue is that these countries should not be independent. They should not drive an independent policy regarding their oil or any other mineral or raw material or anything like that. I mean, look, there was a coup in November 2019 against Evo Morales, the coup in Bolivia. Part of the reason for that coup is Bolivia is chock full of very important precious minerals, metals, and so on, including indium, including lithium. I mean, indium is crucial. Indium is what produces the screens on computers. Bolivia is one of the world's largest holdings of indium, known holdings of indium. Lithium, you know, between Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, and Chile, these three countries, A, B, C, have the world's biggest lithium fields. And these are ready to be developed. Now, the government of Evo Morales of Bolivia had started to develop the lithium. They had, in fact, borrowing Chinese technology and developing their own technology, developed the ability to process the lithium into batteries. And on top of that, they made their own electric car. They were not just willing to export the lithium, you know, to make batteries elsewhere or electric cars elsewhere. They made their own Bolivian government public sector battery car, battery operated car, which Mr. Morales drove off the lot, you know, when it was first produced. And then he was overthrown very soon after. See, that's what's unacceptable. It's not that, you know, you can't have lithium and you can't mine the lithium. It's just that you can't have independent control of it. And they use intimidation, financial warfare, and so on to intimidate you into surrendering control over your precious raw materials to them. I think that's what this game is about. When you go and read the record of Nixon talking to Kissinger in the White House about Chile, what they were most upset by when Salvador Allende started to have his government, they were not upset by this or that ordinary policy of Allende's toward the Chilean people. What upset them was that Allende came in and said that American US companies like Anaconda in the copper industry cannot have free reign and do whatever they want in Chile. ITT, telecommunications, they can't just do whatever they want. Allende was going after US multinationals. That's the reason there was a coup against him. It's not because he was a socialist. They'll tolerate a socialist if the socialist doesn't try to create control over raw materials and so on. That's the issue. The issue is if they exercise sovereignty. In this situation of an imperialist world order, exercise of sovereignty is what is treated as illegal.
And then what is the ultimate impact on the people when they lose their control, when they're the subject of coups, when they're the subject of debt blackmail, basically? I mean, how does it ultimately impact the people of Bolivia or the Congo or Iraq? What's the ultimate price that the people pay?
In 1961, if Patrice Lumumba had been able to take, as he should have been able to become the leader of his government in the Congo, if he had been able to then properly harness the resources of that vast and very rich country, resources at the time, the most important ones were the copper of the Katanga province. Eventually, southern Congo would have been developed for its cobalt and coltan and so on. If they had been able to develop this in a socially responsible fashion, be stewards of nature and so on, you may not have had the Congo what it is today. Look at the price. You're asking the price. The country is in poverty. The sovereignty of the country is greatly compromised. Eastern half of the Congo near Goma is half the time under the control of Rwanda. You've got immense problems in the north, in Burundi. I mean, the problems one country after the other, destabilized by the fact that there was the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in 1961 by Belgian and US intelligence services. Immense cost paid by the people. They've never been able to drive an agenda that is their own because they've been constantly subordinated. Look at Zambia. Zambia and Zimbabwe, as the two halves of Rhodesia, fought very brave liberation struggles against the British. Zambia was northern Rhodesia, a country with immense, to this day, immense copper holdings. You know, there's a part of Zambia called the Copper Belt. In the Copper Belt, which produces some of the world's best copper, and by the way, copper is essential for wiring. Copper is essential for, well, the computers via which we are talking right now. There's a part of Zambia called the Copper Belt, and in the Copper Belt, 60% of children are illiterate. That's the price that people pay for not being able to exercise their sovereignty.
Thank you for that. What thoughts can you share with us about the importance of building anti-imperialist movements and global solidarity at this critical moment in history?
Anti-imperialist movements keep getting built. I mean, it's the contradictions of history that push people to build movements. It's not that somebody has to necessarily come out there and say, hey, let's build a movement. You know, these things are constantly being built in struggles all across the world. I mean, currently there are several internationalist platforms that are there. You know, one of the platforms I'm associated with is the International People's Assembly, which is a network of 200 political organizations spread out over 100 countries. The International Political Assembly is trying to develop a political platform of some unity. You know, it's not like just a one view of the world. There are some solidarity kind of impulses in this platform and so on. These kind of initiatives keep coming up because history requires us to create them. You know, again, we are in that sense an instrument of history. There is a requirement to create them. And we have to fight to defend the right of each of us to struggle for some form of sovereignty in the world. You know, that's really important. Right now, I think it's so important to knit together, create a global alliance of health workers, you know, to drive the health worker agenda, to defend public sector health institutions, to demand for the creation of pharmaceutical production lines on a regional basis around the world, to create science and technology in countries of the global south so that you don't have to rely on first world science and technology. You don't have to rely on Pfizer and Moderna and so on. You can make your own your own vaccines against COVID-19 and then against the next virus that comes. So we need to be constantly involved in building these platforms, not because we think it's a good idea. You see, that's the important thing. You don't build internationalism because you think it's a good idea. Internationalism is a constant theme of the modern world. Internationalism is what history is already asking us to produce. You know, it's not our idea. Let's impose internationalism on the world. The world demands internationalist platforms to be created, and one then just goes and does your historical duty. So I think we keep seeing the emergence of these platforms. We have to keep getting involved in strengthening them, building them, widening their impact.
And you mentioned the organization you were involved with. I'm wondering if there are any other movements or organizations that you find especially inspiring.
There are many that I find inspiring. You know, they are not just organizations, but the struggles of people I find inspiring, very, very inspiring. The Chavistas of Venezuela, the people who are holding fast against this non-stop attempted overthrow of the government. You know, in Venezuela, it's not like the US government has only tried to overthrow the government of Nicolas Maduro. It's very wrong. They've been trying to overthrow the Bolivarian experiment from the election of Hugo Chavez in 1998 onward. They attempted a direct coup in 2002. There's been a whole series of hybrid war attempts against that government since then and before. So, you know, I admire people in Venezuela for holding fast against this drive. I admire the Cubans very much for the experiment that in under great stress, they continue to build their public health systems, their public education systems. They are not exporting arms. They don't bomb countries. They send doctors around the world. I have great admiration for them and for what they are doing. I admire the farmers' organizations in India now. After, you know, 30, 40 years of building a movement, they have been sitting there in a mass protest since 26 November 2020. Non-stop protest against the Indian government, that is highly admirable. I mean, look, the point I want to make is that building organizations takes a lot of effort, a lot of energy, a lot of patience. It's not something that is a flash in the pan. You have to admire people for having the fortitude, for having the patience to build platforms of the working class and the peasantry. I admire people like that. I admire the platforms they build.
Thanks for that. Is there anything else you want to say that I haven't asked you about?
Well, I just want to say that imperialism is a wretched world order. Imperialism has produced a wretched world order. You know, it's not something that can defend itself. It always needs to find other defenses to cover over its own crimes. You know, it always will have to cover itself in the language of human rights or in the language of liberalism or something like that. But let's face it, let's get to the heart of it. Let's rip off the blanket with which it covers itself. And underneath that, what you see is this profit motive. It's very ugly. It can't defend itself. And yet, it has an amazing ability with its capacity to produce propaganda. It has an amazing ability to capture people's imagination. They will also say, look, we are for spreading human rights. And we'll spread it with a US tank, but it's better we spread it with the US tank than not have it spread at all. I mean, that kind of attitude, it's hard to fight against. You know, one of the front lines in the struggle against imperialism is in the struggle against information warfare. And that's why, you know, Pacificat Network is so important. That's why various other forms of media that struggle against this kind of suffocating information war, that's why these avenues are important. It's important to speak differently in order to build differently.
And for people who want to take up that challenge of unmasking the disinformation, what sources of information would you specifically recommend for people who want to learn more or get involved?
Well, I would say from a personal point of view, you might as well go and bookmark the page for the Tricontinental, thetricontinental.org. That's Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. I would say if you are a publication anywhere in the world, you know, I work for the Globetrotter Syndication System. Our stories are free to use. You can just pick up our stories from the globetrotter.media website, and all you need is to sign up for the syndication. You can run them for free on your websites. Doesn't matter what kind of website you have, you can run our stories. Use our stories, spread the information. We have some terrific journalists, people like Rosa Mariam Elizade, who won the Jose Marti Prize based in Havana, Cuba. Terrific journalist. She needs to be read much more outside Cuba. You can do that by taking the Globetrotter materials. And then, you know, go and look at our Leftward books. When you next buying books for a friend, buy them from the Leftward website. Don't use Amazon. Amazon, a bunch of scoundrels. Use our website.
Vijay, I so appreciate you taking this time to share your wisdom and your insights with us. And really, thank you so much for the amazing work that you're doing at Globetrotter and the Tricontinental.
Thanks a lot. Thanks. I appreciate it a lot.